Thank you very much for the kind introduction, and thank you for the hospitality. I will talk about the phase diagram of quantum chromodynamics, and since my talk is aimed at non-experts and graduate students, I will try to be deliberate and introduce the main purpose of my talk will be to introduce the main ideas and just to give the basic picture of the field. It's of course impossible to cover all the aspects. First I will describe to those who are not familiar with the subject what quantum chromodynamics is. And perhaps quantum chromodynamics is one of the most elegant theories of nature. And perhaps the best way to appreciate its elegance and understand its principle is to follow introduction, which roughly follows the historical development of the ideas which gave rise to this theory. So that's what I will attempt to do. So in the beginning, there were protons and neutrons, or in other words, in the beginning of particle physics, we believed that we still believe that matter, which makes all of us and most of the things around us, can be made up of protons and neutrons. At least that's what the nuclei consist of. Of course, later this picture has been greatly expanded. There are other particles which participate in the interactions which bind the nuclei together, or the protons and neutrons in the nuclei. Those particles are called pions, so this letter, Greek letter pi. Then there were, as the experiment progressed, various resonances has been discovered, hadrons which were called strange for their strange properties different from protons and neutrons. All this family of particles which participate in the interaction which binds the protons and neutrons together in the nuclei were called hadrons, just to signify the fact that they participate in strong interaction. So one of the cornerstones of the current theory of strong interactions, that is quantum chromodynamics, and one of the historical first ideas which came about was the idea of a flavor symmetry. It has been observed that interactions between different hadrons or the properties of different hadrons possessed some similarities. For example, the protons and neutrons are very similar to each other. They have very similar mass. The interaction with other hadrons is very similar. And the same went for many other pairs. In other words, there was a certain symmetry which allowed us to relate, for example, the properties of one hadron, let's say proton, to the properties of the other hadron, say the neutron. So this symmetry has been, is now called flavor symmetry, and I will call it as a flavor symmetry throughout this talk. Another important consequence of this observation of the flavor symmetry was that one could classify the hadrons in a way similar to the way that we classify the elements by building a sort of periodic table in which one would perceive or think of the hadrons as being built of more fundamental constituents whose number is much smaller than the number of the hadrons. And these constituents have been termed quarks. There are six flavors of quarks which are known today, and there are only two which are needed to make the particles which surround us, such as proton and neutron. So the typical composition for the proton, it's two u-quarks or U stands for up, and one d quark, which stands for down. The neutron is UDD. The pion consists of one quark and one antiquark. Another idea which came to light as a result was the idea of color. And in fact, it wasn't at all a pretty idea at the beginning. But it was forced to us by the observation that there were some hadrons which were impossible to make out of three quarks without violating the Pauli principle. Quarks had to be fermions, yet you could not put three fermions in the same state. That demanded that quark, in addition to carrying spin and flavor, had to carry some other quantum number which would distinguish those three quarks which we try to fit into one state. And this, for the lack of a better word, property of quark has been called color. There are three colors, red, green, or blue. There is a fundamental difference between the flavor of a quark, which is U, D, up, down, S, strange, or so on, and color. The flavor of the quark leads to an observable symmetry or observable relationship between properties of different hadrons. In other words, by changing the flavor of the quark, one can obtain another hadron and therefore relate the properties of two different hadrons. Look at the protons and neutrons. By flipping the flavor of this quark into U, one obtains from UDD, UUD. So this the change of the flavor of the quark leads to the change of the leads to another hadron. While the change of the color doesn't lead to anything. So this symmetry is totally hidden. And from the point of view of elegance, it's totally redundant property. So this for some time has been considered as a negative side of the quark model of hadrons. This has changed, and the explanation of why the color was important came from a direction which nobody expected. It came from the idea of partons. It can be traced to that. Deep and elastic scattering experiments are experiments in which the structure of the hadron, typically a proton or neutron, is probed by hitting it with a very high-energy electron. The way that electron scatters off the hadron tells us what is inside the hadron. And it turns out that in this particular kinematic regime where the electron transfers a large amount of momentum to the proton, the scattering of electron of the proton looks very simple. It reflects the seemingly simple structure of the proton. The proton looks like it consists of point-like constituents which do not interact with each other. In other words, the electron just scatters off one of the point-like particles which is a constituent of the proton and not on the proton as a whole. So it would be natural to then hypothesize that this partons or the constituents of the protons are perhaps quarks. But how do we connect these two pictures? They seem to be totally disconnected. For once, the quarks are totally bound in the proton, and no one have or the or the neutron, and no one has ever been able to observe them in isolation. This property of quarks have been called confinement. In order to reconcile these two pictures, one would have to imagine an interaction between quarks, which would, on the one hand, be strong enough to keep them together in the proton under certain conditions when we don't try to scatter high-energy electrons of them. On the other hand, the interactions between quarks have to vanish when the process in which each individual quark participates takes very short time. This is exactly what happens when it's being struck by electron. In relativistic theories, short time and short distance are related. In other words, one can also formulate it as a statement that the interaction between two quarks should become small when the distance between two quarks becomes small. Now, when we say the force between two particles is small, we have to say small compared to what? It obviously doesn't make sense to measure it in newtons. There is, of course, a natural scale for the force, which is given by the distance. If you look at the dimensions of the force and the distance, one can see that h bar c divided by the distance squared has the same dimension as the force. Or in other words, so this, at any given distance, there is a characteristic magnitude of the force. So this is the magnitude with which we should compare to say whether the force is strong or not. So in other words, if we make this combination, which is the force times the distance squared divided by h bar c, this will be a dimensionless number which characterizes the strength of the force at the distance r. And the statement then is that when this distance r is small enough, small compared to the radius of the proton, which is about 10 to the 13 centimeters, or one Fermi, this is or femtometer, which is the unit, typical hadronic unit of length. So when the r becomes smaller than this scale, the interactions should become smaller. So the interaction strengths measured in this dimensionless quantity should vanish. It's instructive to compare this to other forces, for example, to electromagnetic force, in which we know that this combination, because the electromagnetic force falls off like 1 over r squared, so this product is basically a constant, which is, if you calculate it, it's 1 over 137, known as this fine structure constant. This constant is small, and if we go to a smaller, a shorter scale, it actually grows with the distance rather than decreases. That's what should happen with the interaction between quarks. This coupling should be strong, that is of order one or maybe larger, at the scale of one Fermi, and should vanish when the distance goes to zero. So I want to emphasize, so this is the property which has been called asymptotic freedom. So I want to emphasize that asymptotic freedom really should not be taken to mean that the forces between quarks vanish at short distances. Quite the opposite. The force actually goes, the dominant part of the dependence on the distance is 1 over r squared. So the force between the quarks is of order, if you substitute here one Fermi, the force will be of the order of a couple of tons between the quarks. And it only grows if you bring the quarks closer to each other, if you measure them in the force in tons. But if you measure it in a natural unit, which is given by the h bar c by r squared, it decreases very slowly, but it decreases. So the breakthrough which has occurred in the theory of strong interactions was the realization that there is a class of theories, and this is the only class of theories, as it turns out, which has asymptotic freedom. And that is non-abelian gauge theory. For example, quantum electrodynamics, again, a useful example for comparison, is also a gauge theory, but it's abelian. gauge theory. The difference between quantum, the abelian and non-abelian field theory is that it's based on a symmetry which is non-abelian, right? So the bonus of this realization was that now the color, which was a nuisance, now has become an essential property of the quark. In order to have a non-abelian, in order to have any gauge symmetry, one must have a hidden symmetry. Symmetry transformation with respect to which doesn't change the state of the system. In quantum electrodynamics, such a symmetry is a rotation of the phase of the wave function, right? The gauge symmetry. This rotation, in terms of the group language, is U1 rotation. It's a unitary rotation with one parameter. While in QCD, we have a color symmetry, which is also a unitary rotation, which involves three colors of the quarks, SU3. It is important that quantum chromodynamics, or QCD for short, is a quantum field theory. In other words, unlike the theories of hadrons which existed before, which at most what they could do is to, using the flavor, for example, symmetries, is relate one property of the hadrons, for example, one scattering amplitude or a cross-section, which cannot be calculated but can be measured, to another one, which also cannot be calculated but measured. So one can relate the quantities which separately could not be calculated. However, here, once you have laid down the foundation of the theory, which for the quantum field theory is just a Lagrangian, and supplied a small number of parameters, everything else can be calculated. So the quantum field theory is a theory which possesses a predictive power in that meaning of this word. So the difference between, so this Lagrangian, if you look at it, looks very familiar, very similar to the Lagrangian of quantum electrodynamics. It has a Dirac part, so the quarks are described by the Dirac fields, which I denote by Q. This is a typical Dirac Lagrangian. They interact, these are the Feynman derivatives. They interact with a coupling G, with gluons, which are the gauge fields like photons, except that there are eight of them in order to account for the transformations, which are a lot more in the SU3 group. There is a F mu term like in electrodynamics. The difference between electrodynamics and chromodynamics is that gluons can carry color. So in other words, so the typical Feynman diagram or the vertex of the Feynman diagram would look like this. So the red quark would could emit a gluon or a virtual gluon and become a blue quark. And as charge is conserved in the electrodynamics, color in a way is also conserved in each vertex in quantum chromodynamics. So the gluon carries some double color, if you wish. That means that the gluons can actually interact with the gluon themselves, right? Because the reason that such diagrams, which involve four photons, do not occur on elementary level in quantum electrodynamics, because photons do not carry charge, and photons couple only to particles which carry charge, right? Well, this works in quantum chromodynamics. And these diagrams are, or these vertices are the important ingredient which actually leads to asymptotic freedom. As I said, quantum chromodynamics is a theory which allows the calculation based on the, or calculations based on first principles. And one of the area of quantum chromodynamics which is interesting theoretically and also experimentally is the thermodynamics of QCD. So in other words, if we know the Lagrangian of this theory, as we do in this case, or the which is the same as we know the Hamiltonian, we can ask the question how this system will behave in a situation which is the domain of thermodynamics, at finite temperature or at finite density. And theoretically, we know perfectly well how to solve this problem. We just have to write a Gibbs sum, and the statistical sum or the partition function of a system has all the information we need to answer all the questions about thermodynamics. What are the phase transitions? What are the phases, etc.? Why would one be interested in answering these questions? Well, there are two typical domains where quantum chromodynamics determines the thermodynamic properties of the system. These are the neutron stars. The reason is that the density in neutron stars is so large that the most important interaction at this density is the strong interaction. And the same is another interesting system is heavy ion collisions. This is the environment which can be actually created and studied in the laboratory. So we have some experimental handles on that. So as I said, quantum chromodynamics allows calculation of thermodynamics properties of strongly interacting matter from first principle. So what is the basic expectation that one can infer if one thinks of the thermodynamics of a strongly interacting or QCD? The most convenient way to summarize the thermodynamic properties of a given system is to draw a phase diagram. The phase diagram is a diagram in which the axis are thermodynamic parameters such as temperatures, chemical potentials, or densities, and the lines on the phase diagram denotes the boundaries between different phases. Right. So this is how the most straightforward or early expectation of what the phase diagram of QCD should look like. Let me first look just along this line. That would suffice at this point. Then I will explain what the horizontal axis is. So at temperature equal to zero, we are dealing with a system which is in its ground state, which is what we call the vacuum. There are no particles. As we rise the temperature, the state of the system at sufficiently small temperature consists of a very low density of the lightest hadrons, which are pions in this case. Remember that in relativistic theory, you cannot control the number of particles which can be pair-created, right? So as long as you rise the temperature, we're talking about temperatures which are comparable to the rest masses of the particles, there will be a small density of particle-antiparticle pairs. So this is what we call the dilute hadron gas. However, as we increase this temperature, something should happen. And the reason that we expect this is, can be made clear if we just go past this region right as far as we can imagine. Then we can see that because of the asymptotic freedom, the system should look like a gas of free quarks and gluons, or the constituents, elementary constituents of quantum chromodynamics. And the reason for that is that one can trace it in the following way. Most naively is that as we rise the temperature, the density in a relativistic at temperatures eventually which become relativistic is proportional to the cube of the temperature just by dimensions And therefore, the typical separation between particles goes like 1 over the temperature, which means that at sufficiently large temperature, the separation becomes sufficiently small and quarks become sufficiently free. Well, to make it a little bit more quantitative, let me... So when we talk about plasma, and this is what we are discussing here, we're discussing quark-gluon plasma. In order to see whether it's free or not, we compare the mean potential energy or interaction energy with the mean kinetic energy. So the interaction energy is alpha S divided by R, roughly speaking, right? Like in quantum, like in electrodynamics with a constant alpha S, which depends on the distance very slightly. And the kinetic energy by the equipartition theorem is proportional to the temperature. So this ratio is proportional, is of order, which is dimensionless ratio, is of order the coupling, which becomes small as the temperature becomes large. So in this region, we can talk at very high temperatures, we can talk about QCD as of a plasma of quarks and gluons, or quark-gluon plasma, or QGP for short. Now, what is a typical scale where the transition from hadron gas to the quark-gluon plasma should occur? Well, it's easy to estimate the order of magnitude by simply observing that, again, using the typical hadronic scale, which is one Fermi, as I already said, one can construct a quantity which has dimension of the energy, which has the value of about 1/5 of giga electron volt, or 200 mega electron volt, 200 MeV, which translates, if you really wish to think about the temperature, to 10 to the 12 Kelvin, right? So this is the order of magnitude. And in fact, it gives pretty good, this estimate has a pretty good precision, despite its crudeness. Now, another axis of the is on this phase diagram is the chemical potential for the baryon charge. Remember that in the relativistic theory, you cannot it is convenient always in thermodynamics to use to describe the phase diagram the chemical potential instead of the corresponding density, right? Because two phases coexist at the same chemical potential, but they have different densities. So the phase coexistence line on in the phase diagram where the chemical potential is a line, right? So, and one can always trade the density to the chemical potential. Rising the chemical potential rises the density. Rising the density rises the chemical potential. There is a one. Now, there is a... in the relativistic, in non-relativistic theories, every particle density can be attached to a chemical potential. However, in the relativistic theory, you can only attach chemical potential to the particle numbers which are conserved. In other words, because of the pair creation, you cannot control separately the number of particles and antiparticles. When I talk about the chemical potential, so QCD conserves the baryon number. This is why the proton doesn't, not only QCD. The proton doesn't decay, right? That means that at least QCD must, all interactions must conserve the baryon number. So this is a natural, so when we say about the chemical potential for the baryon number, what we really mean is the chemical potential for the net baryon number. For the number of baryons minus antibaryons, right? Because this is the only quantity which we can control in a relativistic system. So this is the quantity which is plotted here. When we go to asymptotically large chemical potentials, chemical potential acts very much similar as the temperature. Even at zero temperature, because quarks are fermions, they have a kinetic energy because of the Pauli principle, which is of order mu, the chemical potential. right, the radius of the Fermi sphere. And the distance is of order 1 over mu. This is just having the same argument as before, we see that at sufficiently large chemical potential, QCD also becomes, the quarks behave as if they were free particles. And in order to estimate what distances this should be, this is, again, a very simple estimate. We take the typical hadronic scale, 1 Fermi, 10 to the minus 13 centimeters to the power minus 3, and one can compare it to the typical densities, which is typically contain one nucleon per angstrom or so, and you see that this number is 15 orders of magnitude higher than the typical densities of matter. However, these densities can be achieved inside the neutron star. These are the typical densities. I want to make another comment about the nature of asymptotic freedom of quark-gluon plasma. It's a freedom of a peculiar type, not uncommon in statistical physics, but I should just stress it, that it's not that the interactions between quarks become small. Quite on the contrary, as the quarks get squeezed closer and closer, interactions get stronger. However, the kinetic energies of the grow faster. So in other words, they're not getting small interactions, but they get less relevant. It's a freedom. It's similar to the freedom that you acquire a freedom from a toothache, which bothers you when you spill a hot coffee on yourself. This toothache doesn't go away, but it becomes irrelevant. This was a very rough picture based on very simple arguments. This is how the phase diagram looks after some more intelligence have been applied to the subject. So let me describe it in a little more detail. So it has some phase transitions, and one interesting property is that this phase transition, which we just drew roughly separating the region of hadronic gas and the quark-gluon plasma, in fact, doesn't quite close or separate the two regions. Why we think so is because on this, rectangles indicate what theoretical methods can be used to reach into a particular domain of this phase diagram. So latest calculations enable us to calculate equation of state or all thermodynamic properties on this vertical line axis at mu equals 0. Calculation which is very simple. Well, the idea is very simple, and it's based on the fact that one can write the Gibbs sum over quantum states as a path integral over all configurations of the quantum fields, which in turn, this path integral can be written as another statistical sum for now four-dimensional theory, which is classical. And that can be then simulated by usual Monte Carlo calculation. The reason that it is only possible here on this vertical line is because when we introduce a chemical potential in this scheme, this four-dimensional classical system or has a partition function in which the energy is complex. So there is no simple statistical interpretation or probabilistic interpretation of a contribution of each term to the partition function. It's a seemingly a technical problem. Nevertheless, it's sufficiently severe, and it's not uncommon also in other areas of physics and condensed metaphysics. There are systems which show this problem. This problem is called a sign problem. And this is the reason why in this region of the phase diagram, which in fact, as we can see, is the most interesting because this is where the phase transition occurs, we can only get information by using the modeling, where we replace the genuine first principle calculations by calculation in a model which tries to mimic as best as it can the properties of the QCD, which so at the price of exactness, we buy the analytical or at least numerical tractability. Now, this region of the phase diagram, there is another, well, I should say that, so the latest simulations show that although there is a change from the hadron gas to the quark gluon plasma, this change occurs without any phase transition, any singularity. So it's termed a crossover. So the properties of the system change, but there's no singularity. So this line, which we believe starts from here, has to end somewhere. It cannot close off this region completely. And as usual, in condensed matter physics, the end point of the first of the phase transition is a critical point. There is another minor critical point, which is the end of a similar phase transition. This is a phase transition which corresponds to the boiling of usual nuclear matter. It occurs at much smaller densities and temperatures, but we know about it simply from empirical nuclear physics observations of the properties of the nuclear nuclear matter. Another region of the phase diagram is asymptotically large chemical potential. This region is interesting theoretically because it's tractable. One can obtain first principle analytical predictions about this region. And one of the interesting discoveries, theoretical discoveries recently, was the discovery that there is a special phase which is called color flavor locked phase, about which I will say later. Now, experimental domains on this phase diagram can be represented in this way. The neutron stars correspond to low temperature and large densities, so this is where we expect the neutron stars or quark stars to occupy. So the exterior of the neutron star is at lower densities, starts here, and it goes, as you go inside the star, the density rises, which means we are going in this direction. Perhaps the cores of some neutron stars are in fact quarks, made of quark, quark matter. Yes?
In this contemporary
view, why is it it's because it's a minimal phase diagram. Thanks for reminding me to mention this. So I drew only the lines the color flavor locked phase is different from the phase which we can call quark gluon plasma by the way that the symmetry is realized in it. So there is a spontaneous breaking of symmetry which occurs when we cross this line. So it must be associated with a singularity. There are other phenomena which occur when you go to smaller densities, which do not lead to the breaking of any symmetries. In that sense, they may or may not lead to occurrence of a phase separated by a phase transition, maybe just a region where the certain phenomenon is important. Just to answer your question. I also want to say that this region is also much richer than this picture suggests. As the density is increasing, there may be different patterns of ordering which the system may go through as we increase the density. In other words, it's a very similar situation in condensed matter. As some of you may know, the water the ice has 11 different, the water can have 11 different solid states. So there are 11 types of ice, depending on temperature and pressure. And this, of course, is Well, this is the situation which one encounters if one studies the quantum chromodynamics in this in this regime. Of course, at large temperatures here, it's likely to expect it's unlikely to expect such rich phases because most of the ordering patterns of ordering will eventually melt at finite temperature, at sufficiently large temperature. Difficult to underestimate the importance of one principle in describing the phase diagram, and that is the idea of the chiral symmetry. So I want to describe how the concept of chiral symmetry breaking, shapes our understanding of the phase diagram. So let me, in order to sharpen the argument based on the chiral symmetry, I want to go to the limit where the symmetry is exact. This is the ideal limit where the masses of the quarks are zero. The physical masses of the quarks are small compared to the QCD scale, 200 MeV. So they're two orders of magnitude smaller than that. So we are, in fact, not very far from this so-called chiral limit of massless quarks. So let me, at least for these two quarks, up and down, these quarks are light. So if we neglect those masses, then we can observe the following. So I will denote Q, this this column which contains up and down quark field. Remember that that quarks are fermions, and they're described by the Dirac fermions. So they have left-handed components and the right-handed components. So they could be in the massless limit. They could be left-handed or right-handed, right? Like this or like this. So, and as I told you, there is a symmetry which is a flavor symmetry, which tells us if I interchange U and D quarks, then or do replace each of them by a linear combination of these two. In other words, if I do this transformation, the unitary transformation, the properties of hadrons do not change. However, because quarks are Dirac spinners, there are two such symmetries. One can independently rotate left-handed and right-handed components. Or in other words, usually the way that this split is, one can rotate left-handed and right-handed by the same angle or by opposite angles. These are two. So the symmetry which is called chiral symmetry is the one where I do the rotation. So alpha is a three-dimensional angle, right? In this, tau is the generator of this transformation, the usual tau matrix acting on this column. So this angle alpha should be has equal and opposite amount in size or magnitude in rotation of the right-hand and the left-handed quarks. So this symmetry is called chiral because it doesn't commute with parity, right? If I interchange left and right, the symmetry transformation changes. So QCD as a theory in that chiral limit, if you look at the Lagrangian, it possesses two symmetries, two flavor symmetries. One is a regular flavor symmetry and one is a chiral flavor symmetry, the one which involves left and right-handed rotation differently. However, what we see in nature is only one. Only the usual flavor symmetry is reflected in, for example, proton and neutron can be obtained from each other by the transformation of this symmetry. But there is no particle of the similar mass which can be obtained by a chiral transformation. That tells us that the chiral symmetry is broken in the vacuum. This is what we call the spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking. The interactions or the Lagrangian of the system of the theory based the symmetry but the ground state, the state of lowest energy, does not. And the situation is very ubiquitous in condensed matter physics, and the most straightforward example is the example of ferromagnet, the interaction between the magnetic moments on each side are rotationally invariant. They don't distinguish different directions, but the ground state of the ferromagnet selects one direction. So it breaks the symmetry which the interactions obey. And the easiest way to explore this is to construct another parameter, which in case of the ferromagnet is the magnetization, mean magnetization. And it being non-zero is a signature of the spontaneous symmetry breaking. Similar order parameter can be constructed out of the quark field. So if you look at how this combination transforms, you see that it doesn't transform under regular flavor transformation, but it transforms under chiral flavor or axial or this flavor transformation. And in order to see how this shapes the phase diagram, one should realize that, as I already said, in the vacuum, this symmetry is broken. Therefore, this order parameter is non-zero. Actually, we can measure it. However, as we go to sufficiently large temperatures, we expect that the symmetry will be restored because the quarks are free. And the free quarks do not break chiral symmetry. Well, they are not really free. There is still some interaction. But because it's an exact symmetry, if it is zero, if the symmetry is restored, there will be no corrections. This order parameter must be exactly zero. In the same way as in a ferromagnet, when the symmetry is restored, the magnetization goes to zero exactly. And it is zero because it's protected against any corrections due to the symmetry. In other words, order parameter being a continuous variable, but the statement of the existence or absence of the symmetry in the ground state is a binary statement. There is a symmetry or there is no symmetry. And it's obvious that if there is a parameter which is some function of, let's say, temperature in one phase, and then it's exactly zero in the other phase, this function, there is no analytic function which can do that. If the analytic function is zero in some finite region, it must be zero everywhere. Therefore, there must be a singularity, which is a phase transition. That means that in this ideal world of exact chiral symmetry, massless quarks, there must be a phase transition separating this region from this region. There can be no gaps. What this argument cannot tell us is whether this transition is second order or first order. But this we can determine using the calculations. And lattice Monte Carlo calculations, as I already told you, tells us that this transition here is second order at zero quark mass. While here, although it's impossible to make first principle calculations, all the models calculations which exist predict a strong first order phase transition. Therefore, the minimal picture should be that the first order phase transition should turn into a second order phase transition somewhere, which at a point which is what we what is in the common terminology is called tricritical point. In the real world, when the quark masses are not zero, we have to modify this phase diagram. And the situation, again, is very similar to the ferromagnet. The parameter which breaks the rotational symmetry is the external magnetic field. So an external magnetic field plays the same role as a quark mass in QCD. And as the ferromagnet and external magnetic field undergoes a smooth transition, because now there is no quantitative or binary distinction between the two phases. This is a phase where the magnetization is, well, where the magnetization is large, and this is where the magnetization is small. But it's not zero. because at arbitrary large temperature, magnetic field will induce some magnetization. The same way it happens here. So the second order phase transition, which existed along the temperature axis, just washes out at arbitrarily small quark mass. This is how this picture arises. However, the first order phase transition, of course, cannot disappear because it's associated with a finite discontinuity. So natural questions one can ask about the phase diagram. So how come that these two regions can be connected since they seemingly describe different physics? Well, theoretically, it is because there are no order parameters. There is no symmetry which could distinguish these two states of the system. In both cases, the chiral symmetry is broken, just explicitly. There is no chiral symmetry. However, of course, this does not mean that the physics is the same. Like, if you think of water and its vapor, we know that there are two different phases. Nevertheless, we know that there is a critical point around which you can go from one to another without any singularity. Okay. So here I have a short slide in which I will try to describe the nature of this phase, a color flavor log phase. So they, I'm now talking about this region of the phase diagram. In this region, asymptotic freedom helps us solve the problem. So it's the first, since the coupling can be made arbitrarily small, if we go to arbitrarily large chemical potentials, we can start as a first approximation with a picture of non-interacting quarks. We know what happens then. They form Fermi spheres with a radius equal to the chemical potential. The interaction between quarks, which is now can be taken into account as a perturbation to this picture, is attractive, the exchange of a gluon, if the quarks have opposite colors. Or in other words, in this picture, they have to form a color anti-triplet. In the same way, the interaction between two opposite charges is attractive. So in a certain combination, the quarks attract. And as we know from a Cooper theorem, arbitrarily small attraction on the Fermi in the Fermi gas leads to instability and condensation of the pairs in this attractive channel. So if we only had two flavors, then the most and it's the simplest. Condensation is a curse of the pairs of up and down quarks. So the both of them are right-handed or left-handed, so the total spin of the pair is zero. So the condensation doesn't break the rotation, but it also doesn't break the chiral symmetry. If you check, this combination doesn't transform under transformation of the chiral symmetry. For example, interchanging U and D, obviously. However, a similar situation with three flavors is different. The similar symmetry in this case is SU3. So it's a flavor or chiral flavor symmetry which involves now three quarks, up, down, and strange. And the linear combination of pairs which condenses looks like this. You see that I had to, they have to attract each other, so they have to be in different color states. So I have to cycle both the flavor and color. So UDS, UDS, and I have to cycle also the color, red, blue, green, red, blue, green. And if you check how it transforms, it's not a color, it's not a flavor singlet. So on the interchange of If you swap U and D, you will see that this will be a different combination. However, I can adjust for that by simultaneously changing also the colors of the quarks. If I change U and D, all I need to fix this is just to change also the colors, right, of U and D. In other words, or if I do the cyclic permutation, if I also cyclic shift UDS to UDS, if I do the same with colors, I will not change the value of this order parameter. So there is a symmetry, which is a combination of color and flavor transformation, which are synchronous, which is not broken. And because the color transformation is invisible, it seems that doing the color transformation doesn't change the state of the system. It means that it appears that this condensate doesn't break the chiral symmetry. But in fact, it does, because there is another condensate similar. The left-handed quarks and the right-handed quarks pair independently from each other. And there is a similar combination which is also condenses, which involves left-handed quarks. And now you can see that through, because of that, the left and right flavor rotations are locked to each other. You cannot, in order to preserve the state, you have to rotate the color in the same way as the right-handed flavor, and the left-handed flavor the same way as a color. So therefore, the only transformation which this condensate together with this one preserve is where the left-handed flavor and the right-handed flavor transform synchronously, which is a usual flavor transformation. The one where they do this, where they go in opposite direction, is broken by such condensation. So this is the state in which the chiral symmetry broken in a very peculiar way. And because the ground state locks color and flavor, that's hence the name. How much time do I have? Right. So I guess so. I have to leave this domain of the phase diagram now. And finish my talk talking about the critical point. So the interest in the critical point is due to the fact that it lies in the region where the heavy ion collisions can probe. So this is the picture which shows what theorists can say about the position of the point, which is not very illuminating. This is the most graphic picture I could come up with for this colloquium. This is how the heavy ion collision event looks like in the detector. This is not an artist impression. This is a real picture of the constructed event taken from the experimentalist's website. Each tract represents a particle, and there are thousands of them on this picture. So, in fact, when this picture was first presented, before it was published, some theorists in the audience were actually photographing it because you could, in the hope of trying to make, to scoop others for predictions. Right. So, what I was going to say is that it's obviously very tempting to, since there are so many particles produced, to use a statistical description to describe them. And the picture of the heavy ion collision resembles, the theoretical picture resembles very much with the picture of a Big Bang. In fact, Edward Shuryak likes to call it small bang. And the picture is the following, that after the initial collision, part of the fraction of the kinetic energy of the colliding particles due to rescattering transforms into thermal energy. Once the system thermalizes, I can put a point on the phase diagram. I can describe it. After that, because it's not kept in a box, it expands and cools, of course. The density drops. Of course, and then it traces some trajectory on the phase diagram. Of course, it doesn't cool to zero temperature. The reason for that is that the temperature drops only as long as the system maintains thermal equilibrium, which it can only do if the equilibration rate, or the time which it takes, the equilibration rate is faster than the expansion rate. Fortunately, at some point, the equilibration rate drops behind the expansion rate because the density drops. At that point, all the spectra of the or the momentum of the particles are frozen. This is what in cosmology is referred to freeze out, and this is what in heavy ion physics is referred to freeze out. The most spectacular manifestation of this is the cosmic microwave background radiation. We know it's a Planckian to a very high degree. However, we also know that these photons have not been scattering off each other for billions of years. So they have actually scattered last time moments after the Big Bang, and for the billions of years after that, they just maintain this perfectly thermal spectrum, redshifted. The same happens here, and we can determine using the statistical model fits the temperature and the chemical potential or the thermodynamic conditions at which the heavy ion collision froze out. And this is how it looks like. These are different experiments at different energies. Increasing the energy increases slightly the temperature and decreases the chemical potential. So produces more entropy with more or less the same baryon number. And it's interesting to compare these experimental points with what theorists expect on the position of the critical point. And one can see that, well, of course, this is not a comparison of experiment. It's rather a plot which shows feasibility of search for the critical point using heavy ion collisions. Of course, one needs to identify a signature. And the most promising signature is fluctuations. As an ordinary critical point can be observed through the fluctuations, which leads to critical opalescence, similar effects can be observed if the freeze-out point occurs near the critical point. So by...
Are the units in MeV?
Yes, now they are MeV. So this is a typical example of such scan of the phase diagram. These are only a few points. And what we are looking at, it's very difficult to predict what actually the size of the fluctuations is. There are several unknowns here. However, it's easy to predict the qualitative picture is that what we expect is a peak in the fluctuation variable as a function of the energy of the collision. So this is my summary or conclusions. And since I'm out of time, I don't think I will read them to you. Thank you very much. Yes. All right. So this would require more than one transparency. That's why I skipped this. But yes, if you, because of this strange quark mass, the radius of the Fermi sphere occupied by the strange quarks is different. So we have a situation where the pairing has to occur in a situation where the Fermi spheres are no longer aligned with each other, right? And so it is still open to question what is the actual phase which substitutes for the into which the CFL phase goes as you decrease the chemical potential, or in other words, as you increase the mismatch. So one of the recent proposals is what you call gapless CFL phase, but the story is still not closed because it has been observed also that this phase is unstable. What is actual stable state or the ground state in this regime is still not completely understood. Yes.
Can I suggest that you ask other questions? You two can get together.
Yeah. And one thing I thought about is here L is, I don't know about the last question, but is that an inevitable state that PCB must have, or is it a speculative state that may exist if things work out? And yet, and then, if it is inevitable, I think the problem that the current conducting phase, now does that have any consequences on, when you say there might be objects that actually reach that phase, and that's when how they want to have other attitudes that you could observe and put a bit on, for example?
So the answer to the first question is yes, and the answer to the second question, maybe. Well, we don't know, but we would like to. So there is, I think it's pretty, the reason that we think that this is state is inevitable because this prediction is made in the region which is theoretically controllable when the coupling is small, right? The question is how large is this chemical potential you need to reach is quantitative, not so qualitatively. There will be some chemical potential at which the color flavor locked for a phase is the ground state of the system. Another question is whether one can see this phase in observation of neutron stars, and this so far has not yielded any definitive signature. It turns out that the distinction between color flavor locked phase and, let's say, normal nuclear matter is very subtle. So we can talk about it in the details later. But there are many ideas around. Some of them haven't been really worked out. So I think it's still an open question.
No more questions. Let's thank the speaker again.